Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Betty Bass. My registration number is 16489. I represent the appellant, Mr. Smith. I would like to speak for 8 to 9 minutes and reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, I'll monitor the clock for you.
The court asked us to prepare a supplemental briefing on two recent Colorado Supreme Court cases. I did that in my brief. I stated that In re BJ, I thought, had quite a bit of applicability to this case. That is so, I believe. In re BJ states, once a parent has standing under Section 1410.123 to pursue an allocation of parental responsibilities, the district court then considers whether to allow parenting time to the non-parent. Consideration of any temporary or permanent order for non-parent parenting time must proceed under the standards set forth in Troxel, in the Troxel and CA cases. That is very important in this case because it means that this court can consider those standards from the very beginning of this case. I believe the most important issue in the case is the fact that the intervener, Ms. Silverdale, did not have standing at the very beginning to even apply for an allocation of parental responsibilities, and that the district court judge erred in even hearing the case and adopting the temporary agreement between the father, Mr. Smith, and the intervener.
Ms. Bass, why didn't Ms. Silvernell have standing under Section 1410.123.1b?
Because under CRC, that section, that case says that she didn't have physical care.
Wasn't the child in Ms. Silvernell's physical care at the time she filed a motion for allocation or a petition for allocation of parental rights here?
She had been there, I believe, 2 days.
But does that statute provide any time limit, subsection of the statute?
No, it doesn't, but CRC and several of the cases, out-of-state cases, which have a section similar, that's from the Uniform Dissolution of Marriage Act, which has language similar, have construed that case. And in the case In re CRC says 1410.123.1b, this is quoting from CRC, is limited by the requirement that the biological parents, both of them, consent or acquiesce in the transfer of physical care. We read Section 1410.123.1b and 1c as complementary in that both require volition on the part of the biological parents. There was evidence that the district court judge knew she didn't have an express consent from the mother in this case. The mother didn't get there. She called the court and said her bus had broken down. The court just imputed consent to her. One of the cases that's cited in CRC is a case from Montana, Gerard versus Williams. In that case, the court makes a ruling that volition means that a parent must have voluntarily agreed to this arrangement.
But you're now arguing mom's issue, right?
Yeah.
Your client voluntarily agreed to let the child stay with the intervener, correct?
For a temporary time?
Sure.
And he didn't give away sole physical care because he kept joint decision-making responsibility. That's the that's the importance of the LF case.
Well, all those cases, I mean, CRC and LF and cases like it, do talk about it's more than just physical possession, and I understand your argument on that. The cases talk about you're looking at voluntary relinquishment. It's not enough. And what LF says, it was really, as I recall it, grandma was acting as a nanny, living in the parents' home with the parents. And the court said, that's not enough. Here, this child was living with Ms. Silvernail, right, at your client's request.
Yes, because he needed help temporarily. She asked him to sign the temporary guardianship order because the school principal in Hygiene Elementary had asked that, and asked that the child stay for the complete semester if he was going to allow her to be enrolled with her birth brothers. However, at a hearing on April 13th, which was held in the district court judge at that hearing said, and he reiterated that the decision-making responsibility was joint, and this is a quote from lines 20 through on page 53 going forward, but until then, the current order, which says Ms. Silvernail shall have temporary sole residential custody through May 31st, 2009, that means something is going to have to happen between now and then. She will have sole temporary residential status. She should seek decision making in any issues that may come up. And this is where she didn't have complete, she didn't have physical care.
But does it have to be complete?
I'm sorry,
I interrupted you. You could please finish your sentence. Oh, that's my fault.
She had to seek, he goes on to say, but if you, I can imagine important medical things for sure, any emergency for sure, I suppose educational issues and maybe some of the psychiatric or psychological issues, you should discuss with both parents, because that's what the order was and that's what the agreement was.
So my question is, what case requires, I understand your position, and I don't think it's disputed. There's joint parental responsibility, and so Ms. Silvernail has to discuss. But she had some authority herself, which I think distinguishes this case from LF. What says that she had to have the exclusive right to make the decisions to get herself standing? She had physical possession. There was voluntary relinquishment by dad. She had some decision-making authority. Isn't that enough to get her standing?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. If LF goes on to say that if that were true, then any time a parent took a child, they went to Vail skiing for a week and took the child to a babysitter, then that babysitter could have standing. And that LF says, and this is also ELMC, recognizing the need to protect parents against efforts by babysitters, nannies, and other daycare providers to wrest decision-making responsibility from the parents under whose supervision they provided care.
But wasn't Ms. Silvernail more than just a nanny or a babysitter in this case? You don't agree with that?
I don't, when you look at all the cases that are cited in CRS, which talk about the different situations that CRS, the opinion, encompasses, really. They really adopt those findings. She shared sole decision-making with both parents. She didn't have the ability to completely control the custody and upbringing of the child.
You asked me to give you an 8 to 9 minute warning. It's almost 8 and a half.
Okay, I'll talk fast.
don't rush.
She moreover, in Ray BJ says that the court should not have granted any parental time without considering and going through the analysis which is required. And that case,
that's a different question, right? That after we get to the question of standing, then we look into the presumption and how it applies. I mean, there's two separate questions. One is, did Ms. Silvernail have standing at all? Then if she did, do we apply the Troxell presumption, and what's the burden of proof? I think BJ really addresses the latter.
Yeah, I thought so, except that it says that any temporary or permanent order. So, yes, I agree that you have to decide if she has standing. I don't believe she does. She just, if you go through each of the holdings in CRC and LF, she didn't have physical care assets defined in the statute because, I'll read this again, it's required by the standing under 1B is limited by the requirement that parents consent or acquiesce in the transfer of physical care. Both parents have to consent. The record is clear. The mother did not consent. The district court says that Ms. Lozon, at the court appearance that she made on April 13th, indicated she wanted her daughter back, that she hadn't consented that. She also testified to that in the hearing in August. Ms. Silverman also admitted on cross-examination that she knew the mother hadn't consented. Thus, as in CRC, once the non-parent knew that the other parent didn't consent, he ceased to provide physical care for the purposes of 1B. That's clearly stated in CRC. It's like the great uncle there. Okay, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
4 minutes and 41 seconds. Thank you, Ms. Bass. Ms. Fuller, whenever you're ready.
I guess we're down as low as it goes. I am Melody Fuller, number 10491, on behalf of the intervener, Laura Silvernail. Your Honors, I will also address the standing issue first and then use the last 5 minutes or so to discuss the presumption, unless the court has more questions about the presumption and you'd like to interrupt sooner than that. It is our position that intervener had standing under 1410.123 A, B, and C. Now, the district court talks about A and seems to indicate that Ms. Silvernail had standing under A. I can't completely explain that, how the district court got to that conclusion, other than by saying that I think what the district court was concluding was that Mr. Smith had actually started the proceeding because he had started it previously with an APR, with an allocation of parental responsibilities proceeding before that, and then he started the guardianship. Even if that's true, I'm not exactly sure how finding the authority to file under 123A actually gets Ms. Silvernail standing. So I'd like to really focus on B and C.
Because I appreciate your candor very much, Ms. Fuller. I had a lot of trouble with that finding by the trial court.
All right. And I think it shows, actually, some of the muddling that we do of the issues of standing and the presumption in favor of the biological parent. And I think a lot of these cases, that's why we're talking about them, for perhaps an alternative reason. And it was just because they both of those issues come up in many of these cases. But I would address the physical care argument under B. In 1998, physical custody was changed to physical care. We really are talking about the actual physical care of the day-to-day care of a child. Here, the intervener had visitation with this child well before the guardianship was filed and well before ES was taken to Ms. Silvernail by Mr. Smith. In fact, in August of that same year, August the prior year, when Ms. Lozon decided she would leave ES here with her father and move to Louisiana, at that point, Ms. Silvernail was awarded, or it was agreed by both parents, that Ms. Silvernail would have some time with ES, that ES would come to Ms. Silvernail's home on every other weekend so that she could visit with her brothers. And I think that's important not only for looking at how we got started here, but it also applies under 123.1C, which refers to a non-parent having physical care for 6 months or more. Here, I think we basically meet that 6 months, or we meet the purpose of the six-month provision under C, because Ms. Silvernail had ES in her care by the parents' agreement from January through May 31st or the end of the school year. So she had her basically 4.5 months or more then, as well as already had had visitation time prior to that.
Ms. Fuller, if I may interrupt you, but subsection C, though, says that if such action is commenced within 6 months of the termination of such physical care. Mm-hmm. So how does that fit in with what you're describing?
Well, I think you're correct that C really refers to most situations where somebody like Ms. Silvernail had then lost the physical care, and that piece of the statute would require her, had she lost it, to step in within 6 months.
So does subsection C even apply then under the circumstances here?
Well, I think it does, because I think we can count up roughly 6 months.
But she hadn't lost custody, though. She's still...
That's true. I don't think it says you have to have lost custody.
Well, but it seems to me, if you look at subsection C, that it contemplates the situation that you just described to us, where somebody had physical care and then lost it, as opposed to subsection B, which seems to contemplate a situation where a child is currently in the physical care of of somebody other than a parent.
I agree entirely with that. The reason I mention it is that both B and C are designed to protect the interests of biological parents versus non-parents. And what we have here is a situation where we're looking at, or what those statutory provisions requiring 6 months, the reason for that is to try to make sure that we don't have the babysitter or the nanny or some casual third party obtaining standing through either B or C. And B more directly talks about somebody who has physical care now in its description of what physical care involves.
And so if I may ask you to follow up on what Ms. Bass was saying to us, does the term physical care require exclusive physical care and or the consent of both biological parents, in your view?
It does not require exclusive physical care.
How about the consent of the mother here?
I believe Ms. Bass is correct in that there is case law. The case law does indicate that consent cannot be imputed from one parent to the other. However, in this case, consent was given by Ms. Lozon by her actions. Remember, Ms. Lozon is the one who left her daughter here with Mr. Smith to go to Louisiana. Secondly, when Ms. Lozon was unable to make the January 30th hearing because she simply didn't arrive on time, she didn't file anything with the court asking the court to reconsider, and she never filed anything until her request for the allocation of parental responsibilities, her request to modify those, and that wasn't until mid-May.
Is that after your client filed her petition?
I believe that was. Your Honors, I'm not sure that the exact timing of who filed when really answers the questions for us, and that's because, again, the statutory provisions provide that the court can consider, I'm having trouble coming up with the rule right here, but basically the court can consider the actions in the court to take the place of a pleading. In other words, no specific pleading for APR was required of any of these people because the court was aware that we had a temporary guardianship until May 31st, and at that time something was going to have to be done. And I think there was tacit agreement by everyone that what would have to be done on May 31st was the allocation of parental responsibilities, something more than a mere guardianship.
Ms. Fuller, I don't want you to run out of time, and I have kind of a burning question, so I'm going to jump ahead here. But assuming, for argument's sake, that we were to find your client had standing, so now I want to jump to the merits on the presumption. Mm-hmm. It does seem to me the court at least mentions the presumption afforded to biological parents in its order. what's a little troubling to me is the court, it seems to me, and you can persuade me otherwise, that the clear and convincing evidence standard likely applies in this context, that DS probably is distinguishable from this case. I think you may even argue that in your supplemental brief. It is somewhat troubling that the court never says, I don't think ever utters the words, clear and convincing evidence in its order. And so I guess question for you is, you know, are we as an appellate court able to affirm without such a finding? Do we need to remand it, you know, for the court to make that finding? And obviously the court cites a wealth of evidence in support of its order in favor of your client here, but it's troubling that the court never even mouths the words, clear and convincing, and we don't know what standard the court was applying. Could you address that?
Yes, yes, Your Honor, and I do agree it certainly would have been a much better practice had the court specifically said this is the standard of proof I'm applying. However, as you mentioned, the court has overwhelming factors that it lists as to why the presumption is overcome. First, that it's, I think she says that the parents aren't fit. And I think she says that in a variety of ways. Again, she doesn't use the exact words, the parent is not fit, but she says Mr. Smith is not an appropriate parent, and she says similar things about Ms. Lozon. So I think she started from that premise that they weren't fit. But I think there also is plenty of evidence that shows that the court met a clear and convincing standard. It's interesting that she seems to adopt in her ruling the CRC requirement that if a parent is fit, there must be clear and convincing evidence. But then she goes into this litany of factors as to why the first part of the presumption, as to why the parents would not be appropriate custodians for the child, and then a whole series of factors about why Ms. Silvernail would be an appropriate and is clearly the best custodian for the child.
I can recall, Ms. Fuller, whether the parties argued any particular standard to this court. It may get us in one place, hypothetically, if the parties all agreed, clear and convincing is the standard, and then the court doesn't cite it, versus the parties are disagreeing under this about the standard and the court cites nothing. I don't know whether that makes a difference, but it might. So just as a matter of fact, did the parties take positions with respect to what the appropriate burden of proof is?
I don't recall the details. As you've already noted, the issue and the standing issue initially came up with under Ms. Lozon's objection, and we were in a very different sort of procedural context at that time. But I would admit that if the parent is fit, there is a clear and convincing evidence standard that has to be met to overcome the presumption. You know, one of the interesting things when we go back to, and this is part of the blend of the two issues on appeal here, but one of the interesting things was it was Ms. Silvernail who engaged the child in school, who enrolled her in school. It was Ms. Silvernail who obtained therapy for the child. So Ms. Silvernail was clearly exercising many parental decision-making factors, and again, the parents did not object to the therapy. They agreed upon the school. Ms. Lozon never worked on getting therapy or objected to the school or even made an attempt to come here and resume custody herself. And perhaps Ms. Lozon didn't come here and try to resume custody herself because she didn't really have authority to give it away. And that's where we get back to the consent issue and the voluntariness or the volition. We have a situation here where the biological mother did not have residential custody herself. And so it really wasn't like she was coming here to, she could come back and resume anything or that she could even protest. Her daughter was placed in school at the behest of both Mr. Smith and Ms. Silvernail. I have just a little over 1 minute. I'd be glad to address any of the other questions or concerns the court may have.
Ms. Fuller, how do you think the DIS case applies?
I think DIS is very interesting. I see DIS as just one further case in the line of cases that we have looking at the issue of a biological parent's constitutional rights versus the child's rights to have decisions made in the child's best interests. And I don't think DIS is really that different. What we find is, first we have CCRS preceded Troxel, and we get some good information from that context about what physical care is. And that was the case where the adoption didn't, where the mother back down on her relinquishment. Troxel specifically, the U.S. Supreme Court case, lays out roughly the standard, but we really get the standard explained mostly in CA, and then in Reese, which I know the court is familiar with, and then in BJ. And all DIS really does is say, yes, parents do have these rights, and they have these rights even in the context of a guardianship. However, in the context of a guardianship, as DIS was, the standard of proof was lower, perhaps because they're giving away less than they would with an allocation of parental responsibilities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fuller. Ms. Bass, you have 4 minutes and 41 seconds.
Okay, I see you. The question about whether DIS is helping or not. Again, the case, I don't think it does, because it the holding is specific to the guardianship laws in Colorado. Again, the case Girard versus Montana, which is cited with approval in CRC, speaks to that actually. It says that if the legislature in Colorado, like in Montana, has created different statutory schemes. And procedures underneath those to deal with allocation of parental responsibilities, adoptions, dependent and neglected children. If the legislature had meant to blend those, they would have said so specifically. That's what the Girard versus Montana case says at page 1166. I believe the same is true in Colorado. The court in CRC cited this case with approval. I believe the same is true here. If the legislature had meant courts to apply each of those schemes and blend them, they would have said so. They haven't said so. Therefore, I believe the district court is limited by under the allocation of parental responsibilities, the Dissolution of Marriage Act. And therefore, the court, it wasn't a legal guardianship. It wasn't because, for the reasons I stated in the supplemental brief, they didn't follow the procedures of the probate code. You asked if whether Ms. Silvernail had at the time, this is a standing issue, physical care. I said she didn't because she didn't, under CRC, she didn't have the consent of both parents. And that has to be express consent. Express consent means that directly given, either viva voce or in writing. It is positive, direct, unequivocal consent requiring no inference or implication to supply its meaning. That's from Black's Law Dictionary.
But in this case, I mean, I don't think the facts are disputed that, yeah, we all know mom missed the bus or there was a bus broke down or something, didn't make the hearing. And then, as Ms. Fuller said, we don't hear a word, no motion for reconsideration or anything until she files her own APR.
But she doesn't have a lawyer. None of these folks had lawyers at the beginning of all of this.
Wouldn't you, I agree, yes. Wouldn't you think, though, if mom was so bent out of shape about Ms. Silverdale having the child, she would have said something? She knew how to file papers. She filed papers. Wouldn't she come forward, and why can't we, as the trial court did, say, you know, I think there's acquiescence here, just it's obvious acquiescence.
Because acquiescence isn't enough. It has to be under CRC. It says, I quote that again, it isn't enough. It has to be – And this is again from Gerard versus Williams, the case which, the Montana case, which CRC cites with approval. Voluntary, it does say in CRC that she has to have agreed to voluntarily, nobody's making her allow her daughter to go with Miss Silvernail. Voluntary is defined as done by design or intention, not accidental. Relinquish is defined to renounce some right or thing. Thus, in order for a parent to voluntarily relinquish his or her right to custody, he or she must manifest an intentional renouncement of the right to custody. A parent's custodial rights cannot be relinquished unconsciously or accidentally. And that's what goes with that. It wasn't, she was trying to get to Boulder to have her say. The bus broke down. She called the court. She asked the court to hold it over the hearing until that afternoon when the bus would have gotten in. And the district court judge implied from that behavior, she shows intent to try to get there to have her say. The district court judge ignores that.
Can I ask you before your time runs out, Ms. Bass, the same question I asked Ms. Full. Do you remember whether the parties below cited a standard to the court, whether clear and convincing evidence or preponderance or something else? I'm just curious if that was disputed, what the standard was.
I don't recall that they did. At the hearing, Ms. Lozon did have the counsel, but as I recall, his discussion went mostly to his motion to dismiss Ms. Silvernail because she didn't have standing. I would need to read through this again.
Oh, no, that's fine. Thank you very much. Summarize just quickly. Your time's up, as you may see.
I believe the most important issue is that Ms. Silvernail did not have and does not have standing under Colorado law to have the allocation of parental rights of ES. The chronology is illuminating, I think.
I have to ask you to really wrap up pretty quickly, Ms. Bass.
Okay. The chronology is illuminating, and you can go through. And she did file, the mother did file something as soon as April, and the father also revoked his consent in May when he filed, he revoked his on April 20th. In his handwritten motion to change the allocation of parental responsibilities back to him. Therefore, under LF, Ms. Silvernail ceased to have physical care under the statute for the purposes of 1B, and therefore she did not have standing. Therefore, I would respectfully ask this court to reverse the order of the district court, find that Ms. Silvernail did not then and does not now have standing, and return custody of ES to her father as soon as is practically possible.
Thank you, Ms. Bass. And thank you, Ms. Fuller. The court appreciates your briefs and supplemental briefs and oral arguments in this case. If I may take a moment of personal privilege, I also appreciate the professionalism and obvious courtesies you show one another. It's a breath of fresh air to the court. So we thank you both for that. The case will stand submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.